Okay, we've been looking here at James chapter 5, and here just in the previous verses, the apostle has, or the inspired author has been emphasizing the idea of patience and enduring, even in this life of suffering, and that really has been a theme throughout the book that he's reiterated at various points. But when you come then to verse 12 of chapter 5, just sort of introduces seemingly a new topic, and we've seen this as kind of his practice. He says in verse 12 of chapter 5, "But above all, my brethren, do not swear, either by heaven or by earth, or with any other oath. But your yes is to be yes, and your no, no, so that you may not fall under judgment." I like to talk about this, and just look at even some other Bible passages that also speak about this subject of swearing here. And I think sometimes this is a passage that is greatly misunderstood. I think sometimes maybe the lessons that it teaches, maybe we don't fully grasp. And I think there's really a lot of import here that we need to really think about. So let's go ahead and look at this. First of all, maybe this is sort of a easy issue just to dispense with from the first. But I want to go ahead and just say this. When he talks about not swearing here, is he talking about not using foul language, not cussing or cursing? Is that what he means by swearing there? Okay, no. We in modern English kind of have that as sort of an idiom for a person who says cuss words, that kind of a profane speech. Well, they're swearing. That's certainly a wrong thing to do, but that's not what James is talking about here. Here, when he talks about not swearing, he's discussing what? All right, oaths, not taking an oath. Of course, the whole idea of an oath is calling upon God or calling upon a higher power to bear witness to what you're saying and hold you accountable for that. Or if I'm not telling the truth, may I then be judge, and that be brought on my head. And this is a passage that I know all of my life I've known Christians that have just sort of read this, I think kind of plucking it out of its context, out of its New Testament context, and so they just have read that as, okay, James is saying that as Christians it would be wrong for us to make an oath and call God to bear witness to the truthfulness of what we're saying or to hold us accountable. And so a lot of times that's applied, say, in like if a Christian goes to court and if he's asked to then make an oath and just put his hand on the Bible and swear to tell the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth, very often someone on the basis of this statement in James will decline to say, "I swear," and instead will say, "I affirm." Okay. And so that's sort of how this is understood, as that James is saying, okay, it's wrong to ever make an oath. It's wrong to ever swear before God or by God that what you're saying is true. And I want us to just kind of look at this in the context of the Bible. And I think this is maybe kind of a good passage to kind of teach us a proper methodology even about how we study Bible passages. Because when you think about this, James's audience to whom he says this, they already knew a lot about the subject of swearing, making oaths. So he isn't making this statement outside of any context. He's not making this admonition or this commandment here. He's not saying it in a vacuum. But he's speaking to people who had a context of oath making. And I want us to understand that context too, so that we can appreciate what James is saying. Just look with you real quick at oaths in the Bible. Because really when you look at this, there are a lot of occasions where biblical figures are making oaths or are swearing by God and calling God to bear witness to them. Remember in Abraham, really several passages here. This is not some exhaustive list, but Genesis 24, verse 3, when Abraham makes his servant swear an oath, when he goes into the former country, back to the homeland where the relatives are, to find a wife for Isaac, that he will swear to bring that woman back here, not take Isaac there, but bring the woman back to the promised land. And so that's where he has his servant put his hand under Abraham's thigh and swear that indeed he will carry that out and will fulfill his promise. Joseph makes an oath, Exodus 13, verse 19, makes reference to it. As the Israelites are exiting Egypt, they do something in reference to Joseph because of an oath that he had had them swear back when he was alive. Anyone recall what that was? Yeah. When God brings you out of Egypt, out of Egyptian bondage, per his promise, you bring my bones out with you so I can be buried in the promised land. And so he had had his family swear that oath. And so you certainly have cases where these patriarchs are giving oaths, making oaths, swearing. And never is it presented, this is the point I'm making, never is it presented as if it's something wrong or as if it's, you know, something shady or maybe that they shouldn't be doing that. In fact, I think another couple of passages that really kind of nail this down, the Israelites, the whole Israelite nation, are called upon in the law of Moses to make oaths. In fact, if you look at Numbers 5:21 or Deuteronomy 6, verse 13, these are just a couple of passages of many, where interestingly, God even commands them to swear by the name of Yahweh. In fact, he's saying, don't swear by other gods, but you swear by your God, Yahweh. And he's commanding them to do that. So obviously, this is not something that God views as wrong. And so if we want to understand what James is getting at, we need to understand this background like his original readers would have understood this background. I'll look at just a few more here. Paul makes there are at least a couple of places in his writings where he makes an oath. Remember in Galatians chapter 1 where Paul is assuring his Galatian readers that this gospel that he received, he received that from a direct revelation from God. He didn't get it from any man. He didn't even learn about the gospel by going and studying in Jerusalem under the 12 apostles there. In fact, he even makes the point he had very limited contact after his conversion to Jesus. He had very limited contact with those apostles in Jerusalem, and he recounts these few occasions where he had gone to Jerusalem and had, just for a small amount of time even, for like 14 days, had seen Cephas, had also seen James, the brother of the Lord. And he makes the statement in Galatians 1, verse 20, I assure you before God I am not lying. Now, if that's not an oath, I don't know what is. And it's really kind of the same thing in Romans 9, verse 1, where Paul talks about in his conscience, and he calls upon the Holy Spirit to bear witness that he has unceasing love for his Jewish brethren, even those who had not accepted Jesus Christ. It just tore his heart out. And so even though they regarded him as sort of having become anti-Jewish, he gives an oath. That's not at all how I feel. Just the opposite. So, you know, this is, I think, also something to kind of plug into all this as we kind of look at James's statement to appreciate what James is trying to get at. And I'll just give you one other instance. God himself swears numerous times in the scriptures. And Genesis 22, verse 16 would be one occasion. Remember where God has Abraham to take Isaac and to sacrifice him. Of course, God stays his hand and substitutes that ram in Isaac's place. But it's on that occasion where God then, in Genesis 22:16, he swears by himself says, as I live, which is sort of a play on the usual oath language that an Israelite, say, would have used, or an ancient person would have used. They might have said something, as Yahweh lives, you know, what I'm saying is the truth, or I will fulfill this obligation. And so calling upon the living God to then bear witness and hold him accountable. Well, God there swears by himself, as I live. Which, interestingly, is what the Hebrew writer says in Hebrews 6, verses 13 through 18. I'd like to just go ahead and read this set of verses. Because it seems to me that the Hebrew writer is taking the time to explain why in the world God is making an oath. Why is God swearing? Because in Hebrews chapter 6, if you look then at verse 13, it says, "For when God made the promise to Abraham, since he could swear by no one greater, he swore by himself, saying, I will surely bless you, and I will surely multiply you. And thus, having patiently waited, he," that is Abraham, "obtained the promise." But then notice verse 16. "For men swear by one greater than themselves, and with them an oath given as confirmation is an end of every dispute. In the same way, God, desiring even more to show the heirs of the promise the unchangeableness of his purpose, interposed with an oath, in order that by two unchangeable things, in which it is impossible for God to lie, we may have strong encouragement, we who have fled for refuge and laying hold of the hope set before." So, what's the reason that he gives here for why human beings make oaths and call upon God or higher power to bear witness to their words? Why? Well, okay, but he says that creates an end of every dispute. In other words, you got two human beings who are arguing over, you know, well, you did this, and no, I didn't do that. Well, yes, I heard you say, and you and yes, no, well, no, I didn't do that. You misunderstood, and I never. And okay, what finally settles the dispute? When one of them says, "I swear to you, I'm telling the truth," and then I think he's meaning this generally. In most cases, that's what human beings sort of. Okay, well then I'll accept what you're saying. If you're that serious about it, if you're making an oath and calling upon God to bear witness, and that's really what we do in our court system, right? Isn't that the whole purpose of that, when they have you put your hand on a Bible and here's a religious symbol, and so you are swearing by God that I'm telling the truth, the whole truth, nothing but the truth? Okay, isn't that kind of what the issue is there, that this is serious, and you're swearing now to this, and this better be the truth? And that's what causes other men to accept that. And of course, the reason why that kind of oath-taking is necessary, though, the implicit thing the Hebrew writer is getting at is, what's true about human beings generally? We lie all the time. That's why people came up with that, to make an oath to say, okay, now I know that there are times when I lie, but now I'm really serious. I call God to bear witness. This is the truth, right? And I know there's been a lot of times I've promised things and then I've reneged. But here's a promise. Now I swear to you I'm going to fulfill this promise. Okay, why do human beings settle disputes with an oath? Why is that even necessary? It's because, generally speaking, human beings just lie all the time, and so how's another human being supposed to know whether or not you're really telling the truth now, or whether or not we can really rely on what you're promising now? And so what's the Hebrew writer's point then about God now making an oath? Why did God swear to Abraham that he'd fulfill what he previously promised.
So was Abraham
Lot's
daughter?
Yeah, and isn't the whole point of that? That God is accommodating to human practice, so there's just not any question about this whatsoever. And of course, the point the Hebrew writer makes is that it isn't that in God's case, well, he lies all the time, but now on this occasion, Abraham, okay, I'm serious here. No, that's not the point. In fact, the Hebrew writer makes the point, it's impossible for God to ever lie. That's just the nature of God. It's impossible for him to lie. So why did he make the promise and then confirm it with an oath? Just to assure human beings, because human beings lie and don't fulfill their promises, just to assure Abraham and his heirs, God not only promised, but then he gave an oath on top of that, just to drive the point home, I'm going to fulfill this. So I think that's a key passage here. So here are all these occasions where you have oaths being made in the Bible. And obviously, these oaths are not sinful. Okay. So I want us to move on, and we'll look here again at James and then some other statements of Jesus. But before we move on, comments or questions about any of these passages or anything that I've said? John? Yeah, and in fact, one thing maybe I ought to just add, when the Hebrew talks about that by two unchangeable things, we might have full confidence. What are the two unchangeable things he's talking about? The promise that God made to Abraham, and then that's one. What's the second unchangeable thing? No. His oath. And with both of those, what's true about both of them? It's impossible for God to lie. So by two unchangeable things, his promise, which he couldn't lie, whatever God promises, he's going to fulfill. But then his oath, that's the second thing, just confirms it further. Well, he's not going to lie when he makes an oath either. Impossible for him to. So by two unchangeable things, in which it's impossible for him to lie, we might have full assurance. So that's the whole point of that. God accommodating himself to human beings, not because of God's dishonesty, far from it, but because of man's tendency to be dishonest. He corroborates all this with his own. All right, any other comments or questions about that, Phil? Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, in fact, maybe just to emphasize the point, you know, oaths are made in maybe a couple of different contexts. Sometimes it's because you have promised something, and so you're swearing I'm going to fulfill the promise, which is the context here with God. And then other times, oaths are made in order to assure the person that whatever facts you're giving, that's the truth. I'm not lying about this. But, so that's the idea there. Irma? Yeah, that's the interesting thing about human beings. Human beings with total integrity can promise things that because of our own finitude, we can't fulfill it because we don't have the power to. We thought we could when we made that promise or even swore to it, but we can't fulfill it. But of course, the issue here is you're talking about God. And so what's true about God in his very nature? Is there anything that he can't do? Well, no. Okay. Except for that. So that's why this is such an issue for God. Because unlike human beings, you know, God can't come back and say, well, you know, I intended to, but this world got out of control. I didn't anticipate this. Sorry. Abraham, God can't do that. And so this is what's interesting about God. With God, unlike with human beings, it all boils down to his integrity. That's the issue. Because the issue of his power isn't the question. It's all a matter of, is he going to fulfill his word? Is he going to be a God of integrity and honesty? It always comes down to that. Can you trust him? Which, by the way, is why the Bible always talks about human beings needing to be people of faith. Trust in him and his word. Okay. Yeah. Well, I think that, yeah, that certainly might be kind of one wrinkle here that kind of lies behind what James is saying. I think there's more to it than that, but yeah. Who else? Dave? Originally, I suppose, those originated as euphemisms for referring to God, but yet not referring to God. But like with languages, how words begin, that doesn't mean that's what the meaning is now. So I don't think that's what people are thinking when they say grief, you know, good grief. So that's really not, you know, this issue. That's like an issue of just like euphemisms, and that's a whole other subject that we can talk about at a later time. Does that make any sense? Okay, maybe not. Okay. Look at this, though. How many times have we seen in James's letter, not a direct quote of what Jesus said, but just some allusion to things Jesus had already talked about? It's as if James is just immersed in the teachings of his Lord, his fleshly brother, but his Lord. He's immersed in Jesus' teaching. Look at here in the Sermon on the Mount and how parallel this is with what we're reading here in James 5, verse 12. This, by the way, is in the context of Jesus talking about, you've heard it said from the scribes and Pharisees when they teach you in the synagogue, this, but I say unto you this. Scribes and Pharisees tell you this, but I say this. Okay, well, Jesus says again, you have heard from the scribes and Pharisees that the ancients were told, you shall not make false vows, but shall fulfill your vows to the Lord. But I say to you, make no oath at all, either by heaven, for it is the throne of God, or by the earth, for it is the footstool of his feet, or by Jerusalem, for it is the city of the great king. Nor shall you make an oath by your head, for you cannot make one hair white or black. But let your statement be yes, yes, or no, no, and anything beyond these is of evil. You see how similar that is to what we are reading in James 5? In fact, just let me just show you this visually. Okay, here's what Jesus says in the Sermon on the Mount. Here's what James says. I mean, Jesus says, do not swear at all. James says, do not swear. Jesus says, either by heaven. James used the exact same expression. Jesus says, or by the earth. James used that same expression. Jesus said, or by Jerusalem. He says, don't swear but by the hairs of your head. James says, or with any other oath. Jesus says, but your yes is to be yes. And James says the same thing, but your yes is to be yes. Jesus says, and your no, no, exactly what James says. Jesus says, anything beyond these is of evil. James says, so that you may not fall under judgment. Which obviously implies that that's something that God would view as evil. That's why God would come in judgment on you for it. So, you see what I'm saying, that it's just real clear that James, he's not saying this in a vacuum. And this is the problem, I think, that happens with us sometimes, that we kind of just look at James 5, verse 12, and we look at it completely in a vacuum here, as if there's no background whatsoever. But he is very much alluding to the teaching on this very subject that Jesus had given, and even the various kinds of examples of oath-making that Jesus was talking to the Jews of his day about. In fact, what really I think is just very obvious when you begin to look at even the ancient Jewish writings, which is kind of in my field of special study over the years, is this was that Jewish culture where they would make oaths, but depending upon what words you used when you made the oath, that's what determined whether or not your oath was binding on you or whether it wasn't binding. Did you swear by the offering of the altar of God? Well, as I think back, I don't know that I mentioned the word offering. I swore by the altar of God. Oh, you didn't swear by the offering of the altar of God? Well, then you didn't say the full phrase. So that oath doesn't count. It doesn't? Oh, well, good, because I didn't want to have to give that extra animal. All right. And the rabbinic literature, it's so interesting that there's a whole tractate in the Mishnah that's devoted to oaths. And the idea of oaths that you would make, devoting something to God, if you promised it to God's temple, you were dedicating to God's temple, then you would say korban, which was the Aramaic word for I'm dedicating this to the temple of God. But you could say it in different ways, and sometimes people use a related word konam, not korban, but konam. And in the Mishnah, it talks about, well, if you said konam and not korban, it's not binding. You don't have to fulfill that. Well, so what do you think a whole bunch of people would then start doing if you got all these ways around having to fulfill the oath? What kind of oath do you think people would start to make? Well, I'll just maybe not use the full phraseology or the really certainly binding phraseology. I'll use some other phraseology, which if I determine later I don't want to fulfill the oath, I have a way out. What does that remind you of in our history, in our culture?
The American judicial system.
Do I hear an amen? Okay, let me tell you what. It all gets started real young with us. What, I thought this maybe was what Justin was saying. What in our American lives, our upbringing, does this Jewish practice of what terms you use, what does that remind you of? I mean, isn't that what we do? I mean, don't kids learn that real young, right? You know, where you say something, but I have my fingers crossed behind my back. You know, and when you're a little kid, you learn all the exceptions. I have my other finger crossed. You didn't see that one. So, or my toes were crossed, Don't even look at me, Chris. Don't even. You know, are my hairs were crossed? You ever had someone throw that at you? You know, all this stuff. I mean, we learned that as kids. But that's no wonder the politicians are like the way they are. But that's exactly what was going on in the Jewish world that Jesus was living in. In fact, I want to show you another statement from Jesus about all this that makes this even more clear. But let me get the hands here first, Justin.
I was just going to say, forget kids. How about the President of the United States? Depends on what meaning of his is.
Well, that's true. Oh, yeah. You know, I didn't exactly use this term, and so therefore, you know, it's all semantics, and, you know, we justify and get around, and we deceive other people, and that's how we're deceiving by the way we're wording it. And, well, if they got the wrong idea, that's their problem. It's not mine, you know. And so we're just looking for all these technicalities. That's exactly what was going on in the Judaism of Jesus' day. Let me show you this. Matthew 23, which in many ways, when we had our class on the discourses of Jesus in Matthew's gospel, we looked at this, how Matthew 5 and Matthew 23, that there's a sort of a correlation there with the Beatitudes of Matthew 5 and then the woes of Matthew 23. But look at this discussion of Jesus. And by the way, Matthew 23, when does Jesus give this discourse here? What's the context of him giving this teaching? When is it in his ministry? Beginning of his ministry? No. Up in Galilee, in the mid part of his ministry? No. The last week of his ministry. Where is he when he gives this? Right dead in Jerusalem. Right there in the temple. Okay, this is the last full day of his teaching. By the end of the week, they will have got him crucified. And so this is almost Jesus, you know, last public teaching where he lets it fly. And then at the end of this, he looks out over the city and just laments the judgment that's coming on him because he knows they're not going to listen to him. Like those Old Testament prophets we were talking about. But anyway, he says here, "Woe to you blind guides who say whoever swears by the temple, that is nothing, but whoever swears by the gold of the temple, he is obligated." Can you picture this now? I mean, the full phrase, "I swear by the gold of the temple of God." Okay, but somebody didn't say by the gold of the temple, he said, "I swear by the temple." Well, because he didn't use the exact phrase, then that became a technical. Can you think of anything else in our American society that is kind of, you didn't say the exact wording, so technically you get off? How about in our system of jurisprudence? The Miranda rights, you know, well, did you say exactly the quote, or did you not? Well, but I couldn't finish that because he jumped me and tried to get my gun before I could finish the sentence. Well, but you didn't say the full sentence. Well, then we throw it out. You know, didn't have his rights read. I mean, I don't think I'd just been watching too many episodes of Law and Order. I mean, I think that's really pretty much how things go. That's how things are in the legal system. So this is exactly how the Jewish scribes, and by the way, what's Luke's term for the scribes? Lawyers. Okay, they were the legal lawyers of that society, and they're teaching that the people, well, okay, but you didn't technically say that you swore by the gold of the temple, and so therefore you're not obligated. You just said, "I swore by the temple to give this sacrifice." And Jesus responds to that. He says, "You fools and blind men, which is more important, the gold or the temple that sanctified the gold?" It's almost like Jesus kind of stoops down to their legal level of casuistry, you know, and says, "Okay. I mean, if you want to just think about it on that level, okay, That gold which you mined, which was common until it came in contact with the temple, and now it's temple gold, and now it's holy. So it was its contact with the temple that then sanctified that gold and made it holy. So Jesus says, what's more important, the gold or the temple that sanctifies it? Well, obviously the temple. And so you have the audacity to say that, well, I swore that I'd give God this first calf here as a sacrifice, and I swore by the temple, not by the gold of the temple, so I don't have to give it now. The temple's most important part. So you just kind of stooping down to their level, and just even if you look at it from that casuistic frame of mind, how foolish. And whoever swears by the altar, that they would say, well, that is nothing. But whoever swears by the offering upon it, he is obligated. So, you know, the full phrase is, I swear by the offering of the altar of Yahweh that, you know, I'll give this sheep. Well, but then somebody didn't say that exact phrase. I swear by the altar of Yahweh. And, well, then later, you know, well, you're not technically obligated then. You know. So if you don't want to give that sheep, you know, don't. Jesus says, you blind men, which is more important, the offering or the altar that sanctifies the offering? I mean, this is a calf that's, you know, in your sheepfold at home. And it's not holy, it's not sanctified, but when you put it on the altar of God, when the priest takes it, puts it on the altar of God, now it becomes a sanctified, holy offering to our holy God. It's the altar that sanctifies it. And you're somehow thinking that, well, because I swore by the altar and not by the offering of the altar, that I'm free of my obligation? Jesus says, you are fools and you are blind men. And his point is, if you think God is pleased with that, he says, therefore, he who swears by the altar swears both by the altar and by everything on it. And he who swears by the temple swears both by the temple and by him who dwells within it. And he who swears by heaven swears both by the throne of God and by him who sits upon it. I think he just sort of going through some other possibilities where maybe the full phrase is, well, I swear by the God of heaven who sits on the throne. That, well, if you didn't say that full phrase, well, he says, whoever swears by the altar is swearing by everything on it. Whoever swears by the temple is swearing by God himself. And the whole point of this is their oath-making had become an excuse for dishonesty, or an excuse for not fulfilling your word and looking at things with a technicality. And so I do that most of the time, or a lot of the time, so how can someone trust me? Because who knows whether Marty's telling the truth now, whether he's going to fulfill his promise or not. Well, let's make him swear. Okay, and that'll, you know, Jesus is saying that's not the way it ought to be. You ought to say yes when you mean yes and no when you mean no. And anything else is of evil. It's an evil motive if you're trying to do something else. Okay, well, this is what James is getting at. But above all, my brethren, writing to Jews, Jewish brethren, in this whole context, paralleling what Jesus had said, but above all, my brethren, do not swear either by heaven or by earth or with any other oath, but your yes is to be yes, and your no, no, so that you may not fall under judgment. If, in other words, you should not be swearing and making oaths because that's how people will be able to know whether I'm telling the truth or lying like I do other occasions. Or whether I'm trustworthy now as opposed to the other occasions when I don't make an oath and you can't trust me. Don't swear. Just always speak the truth. It's in that context that he's saying this. Does that make some sense? Yeah. Well, written before Matthew's gospel, but after Jesus gave the teaching.
So this has been going around a little bit since Jesus originally said it.
Oh, yeah.
I think James is kind of, he's the first one to write it down.
He expect, well, but I think he, I think he's alluding to the teaching of Jesus, which he knew his readers were well acquainted with. Because remember, Jesus' teaching had been transmitted orally by word of mouth all those decades until the gospel writers finally started writing down in written form, but they were certainly being spread orally. And I'm not saying this next point to make anyone feel bad. If you are called upon to testify in court or something and you don't feel comfortable saying, I swear, and you want to say, I affirm, okay, fine. But I would just say to you, do you realize that saying the word, I affirm, doesn't change anything? You're still putting your hand in the Bible. Oh, wait a minute. This hand? You're still doing this. And you're still calling upon God to bear witness. It's still an oath. In fact, what's ironic to me, look at what we have done. Now, our motive is good, because we're trying not to violate a passage, which is a good heart. So I appreciate the motive. But look at what we do. We commit the very mistake that really Jesus and James were talking about, where people are just, well, technically, what word did you say? And I didn't say this word, so then it's, I said this word, and so I didn't say the word swear, S-W-E-A-R, so therefore I haven't made an oath. I said I affirm. You know, it's the same kind of casuistry. We just don't realize it. To me, that's ironic. Brad. Make an oath?
Yeah.
Well, okay, the high priest said to him, I adjure you by God. Okay. Are you the Son of God? And Jesus said, yes. But the high priest was saying, with God bearing witness now, officially. Yeah, so yeah, it was a kind of oath. Yeah. Okay. I hope that makes some sense. It kind of gives us a context there. And also what I hope on a larger level this will do is help us as Christians to be a little better in our Bible study and not pluck something out of context and ironically make just look at technicalities and this and that, which is kind of the very thing that the teaching's trying to say not to do. You know, just what's the message you're trying to give? Yes or no, then let that be what you say. Don't deceive and don't quibble. Don't get like a politician. All right. Thank you, folks.